Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Today, it is it's just Curtis McGiffin and myself, Adam Lowther. Jim is, of course, on assignment. And so it's the two of us, which is, you know, it's equally great, even though we're missing, you know, one of the legs of the triad, I guess, the NIDS triad. So it's good to see you, Curtis.
It's good to see you, Adam. That's a great way to describe us, the NIDS triad. I find that interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's just see if, you know, you and I can balance the podcast on two legs without Jim here. So we'll see if we can make that work. You know, there was
that,
some...
Would that make us, maybe we're on stilts now instead of, a stool.
Well, we'll just keep moving and that way we never fall over. I guess
there you go.
That's the way it'll work. So, you know, there was an interesting article that talked about Japan's response to the new Japanese prime minister, Taikichi. You know, she first female prime minister of Japan. And she is, you know, some have described her as the Donald Trump of Japan. And, you know, she made some interesting statements that I was hoping, you know, you might in your best Japanese prime minister, you know, voice, maybe you can share with us what exactly she said, because it really got the Chinese hot. And I thought we might, you know, that might serve as kind of the basis for discussion, you know, discussing this idea of how the Chinese are going to respond if, you know, the Japanese and the Philippines and other, you know, American allies in the region decide that they are, in fact, going to participate in any Chinese aggression towards Taiwan. So what was it that the Japanese prime minister said?
Well, Adam, I am not going to do my best impression. That would be highly inappropriate and extremely unsuccessful. But to your point, yes, the new prime minister of Japan recently had her meet and greet with President Trump. They seemed to really hit it off. If you watched any of that video earlier, I guess in late October when all the ASEAN meetings were going on and so forth. Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi, interesting person, by the way. Anybody who is a former heavy metal drummer is interesting to me. But she apparently is a mentoree of the late Shinzo Abe, who also had a close relationship with President Trump in his first term, and was generally regarded as a bit of a Japanese, nationalistic sort of fervor, interested in making Japan great again, so to speak, and these sorts of things. And I think she's of a similar mindset. On November 11th of 2025, it was reported that she was speaking in Parliament, the Friday prior to the 11th of November, but basically stating that that Japan would likely consider Chinese warfighting in and around Taiwan as being, quote, a survival threatening situation, unquote, which is a legal term that allows Japan's premiers to deploy the country's self-defense forces. And so she gave an example, basically saying that any attempt to bring Taiwan completely under the control of Beijing using battleships and military force could constitute such a situation. And of course, this drew the ire of Chinese officials. I guess there was the Chinese consulate general in one of the cities in Japan basically tweeted something that was, something that was quite nasty, that was nasty enough that the Japanese government demanded its retraction. I think he said this was the, in a post on X, the U.S., they noted this ambassador, if you will, or consul general from China, last name was Zui, XUE, I'm sorry, that threatened basically that, you know, they would have to reply by, the ugly neck, discomforting statement that the Japanese government protested, and it was since deleted. But this has become a bit of a diplomatic tit for tat, I think, since then. But I think what this highlights is that Japan not only has interest in maintaining the status quo within the region. Obviously, any status quo power would want to maintain status quo situations. But Japan also sort of made this statement acknowledging that America is an ally, and that if an ally is at war in their region, they're probably going to have to get engaged to support their ally.
Yeah.
This is an interesting entanglement on the part of the Japanese, right? By having a relationship with America, they could be drawn into war, which is normally the other way around. We're normally drawn into war because of our relationships with other countries. So I think this is fascinating. I think it is very, very interesting that Japan, at least the new government, is really moving from an ambiguity sort of scenario or an ambiguous statement of the past, and moving more towards a clarity of the situation by actually saying, you know, if our ally is going to get engaged in a war in our region, we're going to have to get engaged and involved in that. It's inevitable, and we better be prepared for it. And I think that it was a very interesting issue. And given the history between Japan and China, any statement that has any aggressive tone to it towards China is going to be summarily rejected in some, by the Chinese themselves. They are just not interested in that. And I would argue that Japan may have as much claim on Taiwan as China claims that it has. You know more about that history than I do. But that's basically sort of what happened. And I think what's interesting here as we delve into this for the podcast is to sort of look at this in how the situation is evolving and to the point now where the Japanese are getting much more engaged.
Yeah, it's interesting because so China has, so if you think about it from the perspective of Japan, the Ryukyu Islands, Taiwan is technically a part of that island chain. It was at one point its own kingdom. Mm-hmm. And, eventually the Chinese sort of moved, the Japanese moved down that island chain from the Japanese main islands and conquered it. And then they ultimately, long before the Chinese were really interested in any way whatsoever in Taiwan, the Japanese were involved in Taiwan. And this is one of sort of the interesting things about Taiwanese history is that, Taiwan was historically not considered part of China. The Qing dynasty always essentially excluded Taiwan as part of China. They said, that it was full of, pirates and, the Europeans were there and ran the island. They ran the coast of the island. It was principally, you had an Aboriginal people that were on the interior of the island. And then eventually when Europeans, they were there, but they kind of got kicked out by the Hakka. And the Hakka were an ethnic group that the Han Chinese basically drove south from northern China and then kind of drove them out. And so you'll see that in Malaysia and other places, there's a lot of ethnic Hakka that are there. And so, you know, there's this famous sort of pirate king in the 16th century who was half Japanese and half Hakka. And sort of, he sort of took over the island, and he and his descendants for a period of time ran it. And then ultimately the Japanese gained influence. And it really wasn't, honestly, till the Japanese took over control that you had development of what we might think of as sort of modern civilization on the island. And then, you know, they, let's jump to 45, they lose the war. And then Taiwan, you know, is really just kind of an island again, sort of doing its thing. And then when, you know, Chiang Kai-shek gets defeated in 1949 in the Chinese Civil War, they flee to Taiwan. And what's interesting is, for the first time in Taiwan's history, it had a large population of Han Chinese people. It had never had a large population of Han Chinese. And its culture and language and all that were different. And it wasn't until an authoritarian regime led by the KMT sort of conquered the island and imposed Han Chinese culture on it that there was really any real discussion of Taiwan as being Chinese, because ethnically, linguistically, historically, it really wasn't. It was always sort of this wild, wild west kind of thing. And if you think about it, Taiwan is just as close to Japanese territory as it is to Chinese territory. So this is one of the things I don't think a lot of people kind of realize, is that, you know, Yonaguni Island, which is sort of the westernmost island in the Ryukyu chain, which the Ryukyus are, you know, that's primarily owned by the Japanese, and it's a disputed island chain. But the Ryukyus are, you know, they're 100 kilometers. You know, they're like 60 miles. You know, that's technically closer to Japan than to China. And so when the Chinese talk about taking Taiwan by force, if you're the Japanese, you're thinking, hey, wait a second. So the Chinese not only claim Taiwan, which is part of the Ryukyu Islands, but they claim there's, you know, a lot of islands in dispute with us. And oh, by the way, around Yonaguni and these other islands that have Japanese citizens, they're patrolling and they're acting aggressively. And the Japanese have plans to relocate up to 100,000 of their citizens off those islands near Taiwan, back closer to the Japanese main islands. And the Chinese are saying, no, these are our islands, the Diaoyu Islands, the Senkakus, those are our islands. And so if you're Japan, are you saying, oh, no, don't worry about China, they're just interested in Taiwan? Or are you going to say, well, Taiwan might be the start, but when China is going to go to war, it's not going to stop with Taiwan? And I think that's probably one of the things that's, and we don't know this for certain, right? I mean, there's a lot of debate. Some people will say, you're dead wrong, Adam. You're overstating it. But we don't know. And this is part of why, you know, it's important for the Japanese to sort of deter the Chinese by demonstrating we will fight. And I don't think people may understand that sort of that relationship between Taiwan and Japan and the islands that are just off, you know, 60 miles off the coast. There's a much closer tie for Japan here than people really realize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just to add to your really excellent history review there, is that Japan basically won the island of Formosa right at the, in 1898, at the end of the Japanese-China War, and occupied it until 1945. And it was part of the Japanese Empire, whereas Taiwan or Formosa has never been part of the People's Republic of China. And in those sorts of methodologies, those government, you know, sort of thought patterns and organizations. So it is interesting, and you're absolutely right that the claim on Japanese territory, you know, the Shikoku Islands, for example, has been an issue for a long time. The UN grants Japan administrative control. And, of course, China refutes all of that. Why? Well, because China rejects the rules-based international order as defined by the West anyway. And so it just doesn't matter. And if they view it's theirs, they're going to become, you know, begin, you know, sort of their long death by a thousand paper cuts sort of methods of sort of taking these islands. They just do it very slowly. Wear you down until you realize, you know what, it's just cheaper to let them have it than it would be to continue this fight. I think that's really the ultimate goal here. I mean, it's classic Sun Tzu, right? Winning your battles without ever fighting. But I think there is a long history. What we've demonstrated here is that there's, you know, 125 plus years of maritime dispute between Japan and China through various leaders and governments that is, I think, still in play today. And to Japan's credit, they seem to be not interested in being a pacifistic about this, right? And just sort of letting them have their way in and around the region. Japan is willing to, at least with its conventional military, which is quite capable, and to stand up and say, you know, maybe we're not going to let this happen. I think China should be very careful, at whatever their appetites are, not to engage Japan in a conventional battle. Because of the repercussions that could come from that, you know, the remilitarization of Japan writ large, the strengthening of the alliance between the Western countries and Japan, and then the other thing is not to push Japan so far that it becomes that it feels like it needs to nuke up. China always runs this risk of being overly aggressive, overly coercive, that it forces its neighbors to say, you know what, we have to become a nuclear power in order to stave this off, and then it becomes a diplomatic challenge for the U.S. and its non-proliferation goals, which you and I may not always agree with. But in any case, as American policy has been over the last 60, 70, 80 years, is to try to keep some of these countries not to develop weapons. So then the demand pressure comes on us, right, is to make sure that our nuclear capability and conventional reach is able to sort of fill that gap so that they don't fill it. And then we get mad when we have to pay for all of that bill, or they get mad if we ask them to help burden share those costs. You see how this sort of steamrolls into these sort of political challenges. But Adam, let me ask now. So Japan has sort of laid a line here and made some statements, and enough that it has raised the ire of Chinese officials. It's now, I mean, we are a month and a half away from 2026. some say, invasion is just right around the corner, and deterrence is if that's the case, then clearly deterrence is failing, and so we have to ask ourselves why, and what do we need to do different that. Clearly, it hasn't worked now for over the last couple of decades. It worked for a while in the 70s and 80s, but since the 90s, it's begun. Their appetites have grown. Strategic ambiguity on the part of the West is not working. What do you think we need to do different?
You know, it's an interesting question because I do another podcast, NucleCast, and on that podcast, I had one of the sort of a young Taiwanese scholar who sort of has his finger on the pulse of Taiwan, and sort of contrary to what I thought, his view was that The Taiwanese don't feel a real sense of urgency to, you know, really dump a lot of their resources into their defense.
Yeah, that's
they don't feel threats imminent. They think that this is still something, and remember, Taiwan, you know, the numbers have steadily climbed of the residents, the citizens of Taiwan, who believe that Taiwan is an independent country and that they are mm-hmm. Taiwanese, not Chinese. So that sentiment has grown, but the feeling of imminent threat has not grown. And so, you know, if the Taiwanese, I think this is sort of one of the big things that is important, is that the United States and Japan and others, they want Taiwan to feel that same sense. I did a war game in Hawaii over the summer, and we brought in the Koreans, the Japanese, and the Australians, and we, you know, the view of these, you know, U.S. allies and the U.S. delegation was Taiwan has to want to defend itself, and they need to mm-hmm. demonstrate a willingness. And so whether Taiwan folds or whether they fight, that's going to have a pretty significant impact. And people are watching what arms are the Taiwanese buying? How much are they investing in their own defense? And is their, you know, their defense spending climbs to, you know, 3%? Climbs to 3%. People are saying, right. Well, geez, you know, how serious are they about defending their own country? So it's, in some respects, Taiwan is sending mixed messages, where the data says we're Taiwanese, we're not Chinese. But then the defense spending says, it's not that big of a deal. And so I'm not quite sure, because they could, you know, they could be a porcupine. You know, they could, you know, one thing I've thought is that Taiwan, South Korea, and Ukraine should, you know, build an illicit nuclear weapons program somewhere in Ukraine that's not being watched particularly carefully. And then they need to develop nuclear weapons. And then all three countries at the same time need to come out and say, you know, we have nuclear weapons and we'll defend our country. And I think at that point, and then, you know, Japan will go, well, maybe go nuclear, depends on the prime minister. I mean, some people have said that Japan will go nuclear if South Korea goes nuclear. And you might say, oh, yeah, that's true. But North Korea's been nuclear and mm-hmm. Japan didn't go nuclear. So I don't think they're that worried about a nuclear South Korea. So, you know, it's kind of a, there's a lot of like courses of action, COAs, that we just don't know which COA is going to be the one that's exercised. You know, so it's a tough one.
Well, I agree with you. I think the porcupine strategy is interesting. It is shameful that Taiwan has a smaller defense budget than the United States, even up till at least last year, when this threat has been building over years, maybe even decades, at least in a tangible way. And so you're absolutely correct. And this kind of goes to one of my personal philosophies, Adam, which is that when it comes to U.S. diplomacy and U.S. Defense relationships, we should never want it more than they do.
Yes.
And this is the challenge here is there is some fear that the U.S. may want to defend Taiwan more than Taiwan wants to be defended. And I think while that may be a crazy observation that our listeners are probably all yelling at their steering wheels when I say this, but to your point is Taiwan just has not sufficiently shown us that they want it more than we do, or at least as much. My sense is they do. They're just not showing it. They're still, you know, their military is busy. It's doing things and it's training and they're buying things. Interesting. They just bought a couple dozen M1 Abrams tanks from the United States. Well, that means you plan on fighting the invading army after it's invaded. That's why you're buying those tanks and are on your soil. I think you should be investing in the things that prevents that from ever happening. You should be, you know, projecting farther out. Artillery, and of course, missile systems, naval ships, aircraft, these sorts of things. But I think as far as this messaging I wanted to touch on here is that, you know, the United States has followed this sort of policy of strategic ambiguity for years. And, you know, strategic ambiguity with regard to Taiwan essentially is this U.S. Purposefully not saying what it will or won't do when it comes to the defense of China. And of course, you know, the three diplomatic messages over since 1972 have basically stated, you know, the one China policy and these sorts of things. Yet we have managed to sort of walk both sides of this road. And it's interesting. I think it's a challenge for the United States that sort of has for decades advocated that it should defend democracy wherever it is. And Taiwan is clearly a democracy. And so if that is part of our national value set, if that is a national interest with regard to reputation and so forth, we probably ought to be doing more. If that is something we no longer want to do under, you know, say, America First policies and these sorts of things, then we probably ought to be figuring out how to do a better job of empowering Taiwan to support itself, or we need to do a better job of executing a better deterrent threat. And in my position here is that I'm not sure that we're doing a whole lot of that. And what we've been doing clearly isn't working because they're getting more aggressive. It's not stopped them from preparing and so forth. And they seem to be willing to do economic trade with their top adversary. And we seem to be willing to do economic trade with our pacing threat. So I'm not sure that economics is the answer anymore. This idea that adversaries, that people who trade with one another tend not to go to war with one another, that is really not, you know, coming to fruition here, at least in our preparation as we look forward. So we need to be doing things like messaging and signaling differently. And clearly they are. China is. They are messaging and signaling, daily with their challenges to the within the airspace, their encirclement. Maritime encirclement of Taiwan, essentially rehearsing, not exercising, rehearsing blockades. And so we should be showing the world that we know how to run a blockade, that we know how to prevent that. That's a great deterrent. I don't see us doing any of that.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, you know, the biggest concern that the Chinese have is internal dissension and internal collapse. It's not external invasion. And so my question is, why aren't the Taiwanese actively engaged in, you know, what the Russians call desinformatia? And why aren't we trying to, you know, through internal campaigns and supporting dissident groups and all kinds of stuff, trying to topple a regime that it's not as stable as people think it is? I mean, you don't have to have the world's largest surveillance state because people love you and support you. And that, you know, that brings up sort of another point that I think the Taiwanese people probably don't appreciate. If you want to know what a conquered Taiwan is going to look like, look to Xinjiang, or it was known as the Republic of East Kurdistan, at one point, and look at Tibet, where, you know, Han Chinese people live. They've taken Han Chinese and moved them into the homes of Tibetans to make sure that those Tibetans are not saying or doing anything, against the government. And I can't imagine that there's not going to be a dramatic removal of Taiwanese people from that island. Maybe they go to, you know, labor camps. Maybe they're, you know, disappeared. Who knows what's going to happen? But the Chinese aren't going to just come, win a conflict, rebuild the island, and then say, you know, it's happy to be. Just keep doing things like you were doing them before.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. That's not what's going to happen. And I don't quite think the Taiwanese realize just how bad it's going to be for them if China wins that conflict.
Well, I agree. And if you just look at Hong Kong, and that wasn't, there was no fight back, right? No effort to sort of, when Taiwan actually fights back and kills a lot of Chinese citizens and soldiers and sailors, there will be anger and retribution in the occupation. It's just, unfortunately, I that's likely what's going to happen. So it just isn't something that they would want. And we can only go and look at how the Uyghurs are treated and other folks within mainland China to see how that could be. And it's unfortunate. And so I think while you have your freedom, you should, while you can control your own destiny, you should be controlling your destiny. And that's where I think I would hope that Taiwan would be more aggressive. And we're running out of time. The calendar page is turning. And to that extent, the U.S. and whatever support it aims to do, there was a paper that came out on Foreign Affairs, an article that came out in Foreign Affairs back in 2021 called "The Growing Danger of U.S. Ambiguity on Taiwan." And Richard Haass and David Sachs wrote this piece back in the day. And one of the things I found interesting in rereading this piece, it's been a few years, was that the idea that if the U.S. chooses not to defend Taiwan, whether it's for whatever reason, you know, whether you've got panda huggers or America Firsters or whatever reason that people might not want to do this, what happens? What's the repercussions? Right, the obviously the loss of a democracy. I think the ninth largest trading partner with the U.S. In Taiwan, the semiconductor industry, which we all know is their main commodity, And the final thing is what happens to the U.S. allies in the region after that? Do we lose credibility in their eyes? Do they begin to arm up? Do they pacify and work with China and we lose them too? Do they become nuclear powers and proliferate in order to ensure their own security, that what happens to Taiwan doesn't happen to them next? These are all scenarios that to most Americans are all bad. And so this is where we have to really seriously think about these, how we can prevent that end result that was predicted some 4 years ago, I think very poignantly, it's just not, it's different than, you know, say if you lose some country that may not be able to, that hasn't been occupied by their conquering invaders before, so to speak. Now, many people will tell us the story, Adam, that, well, Taiwan is just geographically, it's not, you can't really invade it. It's, you know, it's got these high cliffs and it doesn't have really any really well beaches. And of course, China's working around that, right? They're building these giant bridges and these methodologies of being able to invade forces, move forces onto this island, despite not having, you know, landable beaches or those sorts of things that wouldn't already be highly mined and so forth. It really is a war of attrition. And then in the piece that we read today, Adam, is this idea that does the war become protracted? Even if we beat the Chinese in the initial invasion, we push them back, will they just accept that defeat? And to your point, the internal turmoil that would come within the Chinese Communist Party after that defeat? Or would they continue to press the attack using the war as a way to nationalize and secure their own domestic challenges to their leadership? If I lose, the peasants will hang me. But if I keep fighting, the peasants will fight. And they'll point their guns away from me, that sort of thing. And so the idea that we'll now look at, even if we win the initial, we prevent the initial invasion, we stop them, however you want to, and we don't lose a lot of ships and Americans and Japanese and others who might be caught up in this battle, what then? What does the protracted war look like after that? And this is where I think this goes to why the Chinese have invested so much in building this nuclear arsenal that they've been doing over these last few years. 700 ICBMs by 2035 is the prediction of our own intelligence community. Where do you think those are pointed at? Many of them, most of them, perhaps even all of them, will be pointed at American cities. And so the goal then is to hold us at risk, to coerce us not to get involved first. Okay, well, maybe we did and we called their bluff and they didn't shoot us then. Then it will be to prevent us from getting engaged in a protracted war. And so, again, what would the world be like following that? So yeah. These are real issues that have to be thought through. We cannot continue to just sort of hope, Adam, that the Chinese will come to the better angels will land on their shoulders, and that they will decide that this is not for them.
Yeah, it's a good point, and unfortunately, we will not settle it here today.
So, wait, why not?
The second unfortunate thing is that we are out of time for this podcast, so we'll have to bring it to a close with that question. So, for the listeners, if you think you have the answer, drop us a note. Let us know what you think. And of course, keep listening to the podcast, keep reading Global Security Review. This week we had three great articles go up. One of them dealt with Taiwan. Lyndall Lucy, he wrote a nice...
Did he?
Yeah. A nice article on Taiwan. So there's some good stuff there. So keep reading, keep listening. And of course, we want to remind you to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.